Thanks for listening to this episode of the Partially Examined Life. Please consider becoming a PEL citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com/membership for unlimited ad-free access to all our episodes and a host of other bonus content. Membership also makes you a part of our Not School community. Other ways to provide support include making a donation, purchasing merchandise, or giving us a cut of your Amazon purchases by using the link on our homepage.
Hey folks, this is the Partially Examined Life, Part 2 of Episode 126 on Saul Kripke's Naming and Necessity. In Part 1, we recap the theory of naming that he's arguing against, which is that a name picks out an individual or a concept term picks out a class of things using some description, some definition of the thing that we have in our head. Kripke thinks this doesn't work on modal grounds, modal referring to possibilities. After all, if you think Abraham Lincoln only refers to that guy because you've got this description of Abraham Lincoln as having been the president during the Civil War and wore that kind of hat, then you should think about, well, what if that guy didn't wear that kind of hat, wasn't the president at all? Wouldn't you still, even in this counterfactual situation, even in this possible world, be referring to that guy with the name Lincoln? So in part two here, we're going to explain that more and say how this can enrich our understanding of identities in science, like water is H2O. And finally, we'll get around to talking a little about the mind-body problem. Here we go.
So let's say what his argument is for this idea that natural kinds and these mass terms are necessarily identical to some underlying thing. So for instance, the tiger example.
It's on page 119 is where it starts.
All right, go ahead.
Should I just read some of it?
I've talked too much anyway.
I say, the word tiger has meaning in English. If I am then asked, what is a tiger? I might reply, a tiger is a large carnivorous quadrupedal feline, tawny yellow in color with blackish transverse stripes and white belly, which is something derived from the dictionary. Now, suppose someone says, you have just said what the word tiger means in English. And Ziff asks, this is some other author, asks me, is that so? And he says correctly, I think not. His example, suppose in a jungle clearing, one says, look, a three-legged tiger. Must one be confused? The phrase, a three-legged tiger, is not a contradictio in adjecto. In other words, it's not a contradiction in terms. But if a tiger in English meant, among other things, either quadruped or quadrupedal, the phrase, a three-legged tiger, could only be a contradiction in terms.
So this is where the idea of fixing comes to our rescue, because it turns out these sorts of things seem to be meanings or not meanings. They're just ways we fix the referent, which is in this case a kind. It's not a particular individual, but it's the way we fix the referent in this world. And then even if lots of those qualities change, we're still referring to tigers. So even if they turn out not to have three legs and to look a lot different, is that right?
There are kind of two things I think happening simultaneously here, which is potentially confusing. So there's one point, which is tiger is a rigidly designating term, just like the name Wes, which means that any property that I think of tigers as having, I can imagine tigers not having. And in those other circumstances in which the tigers lack those properties, I'm thinking about the same thing that I'm talking about in this world. I'm thinking about tigers in this world, except what if they were different? What if they lack this and that property? So it's a rigid designator. That's one sort of set of issues that's floating around here. But then it's complicated by the fact that he also wants to say that tigers can have certain essential properties, which is to say that there are some properties that they have in all possible worlds. So then things get really sort of funky when, well, can I imagine tigers lacking a property that they have in all possible worlds? And then there he says, this is just sort of loose talk. What you're doing, you're not really imagining tigers lacking a property that tigers have in all possible worlds. You're imagining something that looks to you a lot like tigers look having this other property, because actual tigers couldn't lack that property in other possible worlds because they have it in every possible world.
Yeah. So it's the same thing as, you know, me saying, what if Matt had different parents? You're no longer talking about Matt.
Yeah. You're talking about somebody who seems like Matt, but it's not really Matt.
Right. And for him, the essence for tiger, it'll be related to some internal structure or to, it's unclear what these necessary properties will turn out to be. And we don't even have to know them. We just know that this is a kind of thing. And that's the thing we stipulate. And we don't have to know the details of what makes it a kind. It may turn out not to be a natural kind. But if it is a natural kind, then once we've rigidly designated it, we're referring to that same thing. It is that thing in all possible worlds, even if all of those properties that we've used to fix the referent, the kind, the number of legs, for instance, or it's having stripes, all those things could go away, could turn out not to be the case because of an illusion, you know, maybe they were an illusion or whatever, and it still would be a tiger because it got the referent got fixed. So,
yep.
It's interesting that he's resistant to the idea that I find very attractive, that you have an unscientific definition of something, and then you learn more about it, and it kind of gets replaced. Bottom of the tiger thing, he's talking about just things you could discover about tigers. Maybe you discover in a different part of the world. There are things that look like tigers but are actually reptiles. Or I think true the concept of tiger before the internal structure of tigers has been investigated. In other words, that it's a rigid designator. Even though we don't know the internal structure of tigers, let us suppose that we are right. The tigers form a certain species or natural kind. We can then imagine that there should be a creature which, though having all the external appearance of tigers, differs from them internally enough that we should say that it is not the same kind of thing. We can imagine it without knowing anything about what this internal structure is. We can say in advance that we use the term tiger to designate a species, and that anything not of this species, even though it looks like a tiger, is not in fact a tiger.
Yeah, so he's borrowing a lot from these other papers by Putnam. It ain't necessarily so. And then Putnam wrote some further follow-ups in response to these lectures in the mid-70s. But it's this picture of scientific inquiry where we start off by just like pointing at some stuff we observe in nature. And then we sort of defer to future generations of scientific experts this specialized knowledge about what they are. But we assume that there is some such specialized knowledge that future people will uncover. And for now, we just sort of point at them.
Now, is that just because we have the notion of species? And so for animals, it kind of makes sense that we can pick out natural kinds, whereas maybe for natural phenomena, it's not so clear.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. I think it's like even if we're scientifically not that advanced, we still notice that when a tiger mates with a tiger, other tigers come out. But when a tiger mates with a baboon, nothing comes out. I don't know, you know, whatever. We have some notion that there are different kinds of animals. And there's got to be some explanation for that. And we leave it for future generations to discover what the explanation is.
Yeah. Or there may not be. Those natural kinds may not actually exist, by the way. But if there are natural kinds, then it rigidly designates. So.
Yeah, so we might be wrong.
But things other than natural kinds have rigid designators, right? Like Wes has a rigid designator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's proper names and natural kinds. And then he's going to get to natural phenomena, which is a really interesting case as well.
What about like artifacts or any other things and entities in the world? Like, you know, he had a long discussion about tables and ice tables versus wood tables and stuff like that.
So that's the example of substance. So if in this world, you know, a table is composed of mahogany, it turns out not to be the case that this table could have been composed of cedar. That's a counterfactual that actually breaks the rigid designation. So it's no longer this table in the alternate world. It's something else that looks like this table. So the idea there is that just its substance or what it's made of, its particular material, is part of its essence, is an essential property. I think that term is just convenient, so I'm going to keep using it.
And part of what makes it a rigid designator.
In other words, we can vary any property we like and have that rigid designator thing work, have it remain rigid. But as soon as we vary an essential property, we break it. We are talking about a different individual.
And that's a place where I think my intuitions don't match with Kripke's. I'm not completely on the other side either. I just don't think our intuitions tell us anything either way on this. In other words, the question is, if I'm imagining I've got this table that's in front of me right now, I'm considering it. I'm considering, well, what if in an alternate universe, this table was actually made of ice? Or let's not say ice, which is his example, but let's say it's just a slightly different kind of wood or it came from a different tree. That's another one of the examples that he gave. He says, in that other alternate world, I'm not imagining this table being made of something else. I'm imagining another table that resembles this in every respect, but that is another table because it's made of other stuff. Whereas I think why I would be concerned with this table in front of me is the function it serves, the appearance it has, everything that actually makes it a table, makes it my table in my house. And so if I'm imagining another situation in which there's another thing that's serving that exact same purpose, let's say it looks exactly the same, it's the same color, the fact that it came from a different tree, why say that I'm imagining a different table? Like, he's just committed to that.
He thinks that the constituents of things are somehow more tied up in it than
yeah, it's
than
not going to be this properties. Table if you change its substance.
So he thinks it's a more difficult case when you talk about constituents. I think he gives the example of England or Germany. What if there had been different people? I can't remember any, but so just the general description I've given there is that he doesn't have any problem with varying most properties, but he gets very cautious about the variation of the constituents. He thinks it's a harder case.
Note that with those examples, there are kind of two ways to disagree with them. So one way you could disagree with the table example is you could disagree that it's an essential feature of a table, wood molecules it's made of. But then still grant Kripke his main point, which is that when you say things like, what if this table, you know, XYZ, where XYZ lacks one of its essential properties, you're not talking about this table anymore. You could grant him that point and still think, oh, no, I believe the laws of tables are such that changing the molecules doesn't change the thing. But the other way to object to the example is to say, I agree with you that it's an essential feature of a table, which molecules it's made of. And yet I want to resist this conclusion you're drawing about logic, reasoning, and language, which is that when you say, what if the table, and then something where it lacks one of its essential features, we're not really talking about this table anymore. I'm talking about something different. I want to resist that. So I'm actually not sure which of those two criticisms Mark was pushing. It sounded like maybe the latter, which is actually the more adventurous, I think. That's really sticking it to Kripke if you push that objection.
Yeah, I mean, he's committed in advance.
He's committed to
it. Well, yeah. I guess, right, as we were saying, that he uses these essential properties as examples that he thinks are going to jibe with our intuitions. And he doesn't really argue for any of that.
Right.
Do the thought experiment yourself. And if you really think that you can imagine a Matt in another world that was born of different parents, or a Matt that is a girl because he had different chromosomes or something, some different genes,
yeah,
then more power to you. I think those are things that clearly are meant to break our intuitions. I don't think we have clear intuitions about them at all, and there's no reason we should.
Yeah. Do you think there are other examples of essential properties that we have clear intuitions about? Or is essential properties just something where our intuitions generally break down?
Okay, so this is just speculation. Yeah. But yeah, it seems like that why we would consider something an essential property or not, you know, you got to think that it has something to do with our psychological makeup, with the history of ideas, with the society that we're in particular. So maybe in some places, see if this works. Is there a possible world? Is there a possible country even in this world in which they might not have the same intuitions that we do about, oh, if you had different parents, you're a different person. Like, for instance, if you strongly feel that, and I think Kripke actually brings this up, that what's important about the person is the soul. So you could have different parents, and as long as the same soul gets in there, then it's the same person. Well, if you've got that picture, your intuitions are not going to tell you the same thing about the biology.
Yeah, yeah. So if you really want to hold to a distinction between a soul and a body, I think that's a way to resist the idea that you essentially have the parents. Yeah. So, but what about, like, what about essentially being an animal? So, you know, let's say I have a pet rat. Can I speculate? What if my pet rat were in fact a plant? Like, that seems a little weird, doesn't it?
Or what if my pet rat were a robot that I could, well, that means I wouldn't have to feed it anymore. Mm-hmm. I could run it all day and I could turn it off when I was irritated by it.
Yeah.
And what you're really asking in that situation, yeah, you're really not asking if this pet rat were had those situations. You're asking, what if I had a pet rat that was very much like this pet rat and had all the good qualities I like about this pet rat, but didn't have any of the downsides?
Yeah.
So I think the way I just described it, actually, Kripke would be.
Yeah, no, that's it. You were just making his argument. Yeah.
You just have to admit that you're not actually talking about your pet rat anymore.
Right.
But so this, I mean, we've talked about before about, you know, in our sci-fi context. So if your mind was uploaded into a computer, according to every sci-fi book, so your mind that is in the computer now and has now been living there, this is in David Brin's existence that we discussed. So your mind is in the computer, thinks of it as you. It thinks that it's you, but it gets to live for, you know, however many thousands of years or whatever until the computer breaks down. And it could even just migrate to a new computer. It has all these, it has personal identity. It has whatever the criteria, the Lockean, it has your memories.
Right.
But yet we obviously want to say, well, the original you actually died. This is a copy of you.
But this is actually a good case in favor of Kripke, right? Because we could simply clone your brain as many times as we like. And it doesn't mean, you know, all those different individuals are now the same person, Mark, although they may all be, you know, Mark 1, Mark 2. But you understand what I'm saying? You would have a bunch of different individuals, even though qualitatively all those individuals are exactly the same. So just their numerical distinctness is enough. And that's part of the intuition that Kripke is getting at, I think.
And it's interesting, though, that he doesn't think that breaks down, again, when you're considering possible worlds, that he still thinks that you might think that the me in this world is numerically distinct from the me in any other possible situation. It's not the same me. But that's slipping back into the David Lewis wrong view of possible worlds, according to that. You're stipulating that it's you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But the point is, the stipulation is just there's something analogous between that stipulation and just what I talked about as being, obviously the case of personal identity is, we're talking about something that's only analogous here. It's not the same sort of identity as across possible worlds. But the reason why it was interesting was because it also goes against this idea that what determines an identity, something's identity in the possible world, is its description. Because when I clone you, Mark, then I have a bunch of things, and then the arguments get ornate because then there's the spatiotemporal location and so on and so forth, and you can count those in the description. But you get the general idea. I could have a bunch of different qualitatively identical to Mark, but their mere numerical distinctness makes some difference. So.
Right. Well, and that's what is supposed to direct you. So if we're approaching the sci-fi problem, am I the same person after I've teleported or after I've been uploaded to the machine or whatever, having multiple copies of you, I teleported, but my old body stayed there. So actually there are two of me. That's supposed to clarify your intuitions to say, oh, actually those are different. if you don't have the clone issue, then I think our intuitions really are indeterminate. If I were to tell you, you know, I'm going to upload you to a computer, you're going to remember everything you remember. It's just you're going to have a lot of advantages you don't now have. Well, you'll be in a computer, so maybe that's a disadvantage. So it'll be very different for you, but you'll still feel like you. And you might buy that, especially if you're about to die anyway, and somebody says, I'm going to offer you immortality. It's not clear that you would just say, well, that won't be me. Fuck that.
What if someone puts you into 7 different computers? Which one is you?
Yes, I acknowledge that that breaks it down.
That's such a thorny topic, which we should eventually do someday. But
personal identity. But doesn't it seem relevant here for this?
Yeah.
Did we not milk all of its relevance yet?
Well, I'm wondering if you avoid those thorny issues by just asking, it's the same person that walks behind a wall and you see them go on one side of the wall and they exit out the other side of the wall. Is it the same person? Or am I the same person spatiotemporally right. as I was yesterday or when I walk across the room? Any of those things. I mean, did it become any genuinely more complicated by talking about multiple uploadings of ourselves into multiple computers?
I think identity is over time is just as
okay.
as thorny, and it's also relevant, actually, yeah, to the question of personal identity.
He wants to bypass all that, I think,
yeah.
in this discussion. He thinks it's not relevant somehow.
We're not thinking about the same thing. We are just – this kind of identity is different. That this trans world identity is a whole different can of worms.
Can we have a possible world in which time runs slower? So in this possible world, at the time corresponding to today, it's actually yesterday. So is it me? Is there any way to set up this kind of example without violating Kripke's rule of stipulating how you stipulate possible worlds? It sounds like I'm doing another Lewis thing. I'm trying to describe another situation. I'm asking, is this actually me or not? In the way that Dylan was just bringing up.
And we're assuming for the sake of argument, well, we have some way of comparing times between two worlds.
You're trying to come up with a possible world scenario to evaluate what the essential properties are.
Or another way to put this is whether certain temporal properties are essential to you.
That I be here, that I...
Being here now, man.
Probably not.
When pressed, it seems like he wants to say, okay, just assume, like for the meter, he says this specifically, the meter stick, fine, the meter stick itself might change over time. So let's just define the meter as the meter at time P. So really, if we're going to say, well, what if compare me to what might have happened in other possible worlds, it's me at time P. He seems to be trying to avoid in the same way, right?
Yeah, if Nixon didn't win the election, then obviously any counterfactual is going to produce a lot of differences at any given time. But is that maybe that's not what you're talking about?
Actually, now I think the thing I was positing isn't going to work. Because when you say, you know, well, what if Nixon hadn't won the election? You're obviously considering sort of Nixon in his whole life. You're not saying, compare Nixon as of, you know, the moment before his death.
Right.
And
right.
then think about, what if that guy in, you know, another possible world hadn't gone into politics in the first place? Well, then clearly you're not concerned exactly with the moment of his death anymore. Either in the possible world you're looking at or in the source, in the actual world. You're considering Nixon as a person who has to then be rigidly picked out across his life. You're assuming that there is an identity, just because this is what we do in language already.
Assuming transtemporal identity, we need that or else we can't do this.
Like, what if Martin Luther King hadn't been killed? He would have made great changes. What if Jimi Hendrix had lived to the end of the 70s? He would have done some awesome disco. We say stuff like that a lot, right? That particular case we say all the time, you know, especially.
You've blown my mind.
How did this identity discussion in Kripke deal with the notion of something staying the same but evolving in time? And maybe it's as simple as something getting older, just a biological thing, but it would also be true of any kind of change. What counts as something that means that it's not identical to what it was before? And there would be complicated things like saying, well, I'm not the same person that I was 5 years ago before I underwent this trauma. Or I am a different person now that I've served time in prison. Or maybe less complicated things like you have some kind of artifact that this hammer that my grandfather had that I replaced the handle on 5 times. Is it right. the same hammer?
He avoids all of those questions. Okay. So he just
matter.
Assumes, he assumes, we sort of take for granted that there is transtemporal identity. And yes, it's a mystery of how that happens, but it's not one that he's going to address. So he's going to say assume for the sake of argument that we can have the same individual existing across time within this actual world.
So it's really, it's a different dimension of the problem of identity that he's focusing on.
Yeah, but I think one relies on the other, actually. We have to stipulate transtemporal identity before we talk about trans world identity. Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I think you actually, I mean, it all depends on what exactly a world is and whatnot. And different people have different views on that. But I think there's a very close connection. So if you think of the future turning into the present as the coalescing of a possibility into actuality, then you could see the persistence over time is just a special case of this more general issue of transworld identity. In part, it depends on how you think of time. But I think they are actually pretty closely connected.
Yeah, Kripke's view of possible worlds, I think, is not going to be like that. A possible world has nothing in common with actual changes of, you know, this world at time t and at time t1. That's going to be a fundamentally different relation than what if, than anything with a modality.
Well, but when we talk about the future, though, I think there's at least a case to be made that we're talking about possibilities and what if they happen, you know?
Yeah.
What if it rains tomorrow? Well, we're talking about a possible world in which it rains tomorrow, and we're asking, is that possible world the actual world? And, you know, it's not raining right now, but is the possibility of it's raining going to be one that comes to pass? I don't know.
It just sounds like that's epistemic. He seems to want to rule that out as relevant across the board. The important distinction that he's trying to make in here is that you might have thought that what is possible is a factor of what is unknown. You know, if we don't know it yet, then it's still possible. But that he wants to say that the epistemic and the metaphysical are just totally different realms. And the fact that we don't know what's going to happen later today doesn't mean that there are actually, in a metaphysical real way, two different possibilities or many different possibilities. I think he's just not committing either way. Maybe that rigid metaphysical determination is in fact true. And so the actual world, there really is only one future. It's already mapped out, but we could still talk about possibilities.
This issue bears out. So in philosophy of language and tense logic, there are sort of two theories of the future. One theory of the future is there's basically just a timeline. There's a line from the past up to the present, and then it just extends forward. And this goes along with a deterministic world picture. That is to say, the events of the future are exhaustively determined by what happened in the past. There's no randomness. But then there's another model of branching times, which is basically every moment from the present, it branches out in possible futures. And then every point in every one of those futures branches out into infinitely many more futures. And you get this, you know, ridiculous fractal looking tree of opening, splitting futures, extending past the present. But there's always this debate that you just mentioned of our laws about what's going to happen in the future. Are those just laws about what we're confident about, or are they laws about what in fact is going to happen in the future? So that's always and Kripke's definitely not weighing in on that question.
So we've established quite a few things that Kripke's not weighing in on.
Yeah, we have been off the beaten path for a while. I mean, I think there's like three things we should talk about before the end of this. I mean, one is his causal theory of reference.
Yeah, we should definitely talk about the baptism stuff. Yeah,
we should talk about mind-brain identity. But before, to set that up, we'll have to talk about the natural phenomena stuff, you know, heat feeling versus heat and stuff like that. But
I think that's a good way to wrap up.
All right. So what's the first? His actual positive view, which he says, I'm not even going to give details on it. I'm sketching it out, and it sounds more plausible than these things I've been arguing against. He's admitting that this whole book, at least the first two lectures, are a critique of the Frege-Russell view. And he's only going to hint at his own view, which I guess he developed later, or other folks developed later.
It's become pretty much, I think it's the most popular, either it or a modification or hybrid sorts of theories. There are some hybrid theories which mix him up with definite descriptions, but it is like a popular theory of reference now, and it's been developed in the different directions by a lot of different people. But Matt?
Yeah, here he says, I'm not going to give a theory because theories are all wrong, which is delightful. by definition, if it's a theory, it's wrong. You know, he's kind of joking. But so he calls it a causal picture of reference rather than a causal theory of reference. And then other people who are at various times students of his, like Michael Devitt, have tried to make this, what we get in this book, which is a picture, whatever exactly that means, into a theory, which presumably means it's worked out in more detail and it's trying to account for all possible counterexamples and that kind of thing.
Is it? It's on 96, I think.
Yeah.
So that's where, he gives his nice summary of it.
And the question that this is trying to answer is the one that I think Wes opened by asking, and which I didn't really address. I instead started talking about the meaning of a name. But this question, what fact of the matter determines that the name Mark refers to that dude over there?
And if it's not definite descriptions, he needs some sort of replacement picture.
Yeah. So if the answer to that question isn't whatever is uniquely identified by this description, then you got to have some other answer to what fact of the matter determines that this name refers to this person.
So in this case, he talks about, again, the fixing idea here. So when he talks about this, there's an initial baptism, which is someone's encounter with the referent, the thing in the world. The baptism could take the form of ostension, just pointing at it. It might be some sort of description. Could even be like, if I meet Mark, the description might be the guy who I'm meeting right now, and then the name is Mark. But then after that, so then the reference is passed on from person to person in a sort of linguistic community. And it's not necessary that later users of the reference mark know much about him at all. Everything they know about him can, in fact, be wrong. And that's where the, you know, you get the contradiction with the definite description theory. So they don't need this unique way of picking Mark out. Everything they know could be wrong. It's just that there's this chain, this linkage between speakers that goes all the way back to this initial baptism.
And that each link in the chain at least intends to use it right. correctly.
Or intends to use it, yeah, in the way the previous speaker used
it. Yeah, they intend to borrow it from the previous person. The previous time they heard the name used, they tend to kind of piggyback on that.
So if they name their dog Mark, then that's not, obviously, the dog doesn't somehow become the referent. It's just that they're using it in a different way.
So. All right, the pet aardvark example.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that sounds really obvious once you spell it out, but he does get into different possible exceptions of that, like that Santa Claus probably was connected with some actual person, some saint. But the way that the referent flowed didn't obey that, you know, that every speaker intended to use it correctly the way the previous one did. As legends grow about it, then people start talking about the guy in the story rather than the initial saint. So it's people talking about Santa Claus now are not just referring to this original saint that died a long time ago and are just saying false things about him. They're saying true things about a literary figure who's grown up itself so that you could have... You know, it changed its referent at some point. And he gives Madagascar as another example that the only reason, you know, apparently the natives of, this is in the preface that when he's giving other examples that he wrote after he gave these initial lectures, that the natives of that area of Africa called Madagascar actually some part of the mainland. But it was Marco Polo that screwed up and thought it was referred to the island. And so everybody followed him on that. And eventually everybody, even people locally, call the island Madagascar. So that is a case in which it's not that everybody is, you know, if the historical chain actually goes back to referring to the mainland, that everybody right now, when they say Madagascar, are in fact referring to the mainland and they're just saying false things about it. No. They're actually referring to the island. They know what they're referring to. So these are just fringe cases where something goes wrong in the chain of reference. Or he gives another one about, I know my neighbor, George Smith, but I bring up him as an example in a philosophy lecture. And I just kind of whimsically refer to, you know, I really just kind of pick the name out of a hat. I'm really not. And so my students learn all this stuff about George Smith. Are they learning stuff about my neighbor? Well, no, they're really learning about this literary figure that I've created for the purposes of a philosophical example. And maybe are having correct views, beliefs about him. They're not having erroneous beliefs about my neighbor. They're not thinking about my neighbor at all, even though I use the same name.
Yeah, and these are exactly all the kinds of problem cases that if Kripke were giving a causal theory of reference, perhaps he would have to have something to say about. But since he's just sketching out a picture, as he says, he leaves it to later people to worry about those cases.
Can I ask a question about how this would be different for Russell and Frege? Because the way in which it's talked about, it just, as Mark mentioned, it just seems sort of obvious. Like, what kind of tortured way were you speaking about this problem before?
Yeah, and this is the feeling I had reading this book, yeah.
Such that now you're going, duh, why were we being so stupid before? And what I don't know is what we were being stupid about. Like, what was the way in which you would analyze this problem that would have before? Or is it that these cases Kripke needs to address because they simply were danglers in the previous theory? They just weren't addressed. Or I don't know. I mean, I'm just asking to be filled in on it.
Okay, those three exceptions that I gave were not, as Matt just says, things that he doesn't feel he needs to address. By spelling them out, he is addressing them. He's saying, in this case, something went wrong. He's trying to be more precise, actually, not just leave something out, more precise about the chain of causality, that there's something, you're right, he's not completely filling in, there's more to say. If he wants to sort of put each of these exceptions into a general class and say exactly what's going wrong in the chain of causation. But at this point, he's just saying, you know, there's a chain of causation that has to work in a certain way, and you'll get the idea if I give you these examples of where it goes wrong.
But is this something, a new feature that he's developing within this causal theory of reference? Is that just not part of previous theories, or?
I think for a descriptivist, you have to have something. It's not just the fact that you picked up this usage from someone else. It's that your understanding, an idea that you have in your head when you use the term, is the meaning of the term, is the description of the term. And that is the thing that fixes the referent. And that's what he's arguing against.
But we have to remember that those definite descriptions were motivated, right? We gave all those cases in which they were very helpful and they established a certain relationship between meaning and reference. I'm not sure how well the causal theory deals with all of that, and it certainly raises new puzzles that even Kripke doesn't mention here that'll have to be addressed. But I had the same reaction as Dylan, which is that to me it's intuitively much more satisfying, and it makes the definite description approach seem almost absurdly scholastic, right?
But notice how one of the main problems that motivated the Russell theory was this problem of negative existentials, and Russell's theory, I mean, at least does a passable job of addressing that. Notice how that comes right back once you adopt the causal theory of reference. Because how would you baptize somebody who doesn't exist? How would you baptize Santa Claus, Santa Claus? So he is creating some additional work for himself, which he does actually in a different book, which only recently came out, which is a transcription of his Locke lectures. But that whole book is about fictional names. He's going to have to really figure out some fancy footwork, because it's not at all clear from what we read what he would say about names that don't refer, like Santa Claus.
I thought he brought up that, and he brought up Sherlock Holmes, and they both sounded satisfying mm-hmm. to me by saying the person in the story, like that's the baptism, is that I wrote a story about this guy, Sherlock Holmes. And then from then on, everybody that refers to it is just referring to this character I set up. That seems not problematic at all.
That's maybe a good first stab at Sherlock Holmes, though. What about Santa Claus, though? I'm not sure you can. It's a character?
Yeah.
Then the character doesn't exist, you're saying, yeah. when you say Santa Claus doesn't exist? I don't think that's what you're saying. This character isn't an actual person.
It's a fictional story. Just like God. Just let's not go there.
Like Don Quixote or Frankenstein or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, right?
But I guess the difference is that it's not one story that it's referring to. It's not like Sherlock Holmes that was invented by a particular author at a particular time, that it's a legend that's evolved over time. And okay, so let's say Zeus, I think we can safely agree, is fictional. Where did that come from? Where was the initial baptism? People looked at lightning in the sky and they said, there's Zeus doing things like, you know, somebody at some point came up with that idea. And so there was something like an initial baptism in the creation of the legend. And then we can understand how legends grow and all that. Anyway, it is interesting. And it does seem like it would be interesting to read his further book.
Yes.
But I'm satisfied with what he gave
here.
But
Santa Claus doesn't exist. Can't be saying that the legend of Santa Claus doesn't exist.
That's not what it's saying at all.
Yeah, exactly.
As depicted in the legend does not actually exist in the real world.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if I say, hey, I wrote a whole bunch of books on this character, Dark Shadow, then you discover, actually, I'm lying. I never wrote any books on that at all. There is no such character as Dark Shadow. Then in that case, it would be correct to say that even the legend does not exist.
Yeah, and that seems like that's different from what people normally are saying when they say Santa Claus doesn't exist. They're saying the person doesn't, rather than there was never a legend.
Yes.
So this is a potential problem, I think, this is a bunch of extra work that Russell didn't have to do that Kripke now has to do to, like, sort through those cases.
Is there a corresponding problem with general terms, with unicorns?
No, because there's no reference to otherworldly entities in the Russell reanalysis of Santa Claus doesn't exist. It's only about the actual world. It's not about anything. Yeah.
I mean, for Kripke. You say he has to do some work to deal with Santa Claus. Does he also have to deal with unicorn?
Ordinarily, no, except that there's a lot of open-endedness about what exactly is the relation between a natural kind term and a proper name. Kripke says that natural kind terms are rigid designators as well, but there's a lot of questions he leaves unanswered about what it is for a predicate to rigidly designate, because presumably, so let's say Matt denotes the same person in all possible worlds. That's what it means for Matt to rigidly designate. But the predicate unicorn, that's going to have a different extension, different possible worlds. There are going to be different things that are unicorns at different possible worlds. Is that right?
No, because he says, actually, I think he talks specifically about unicorns, that he says that there are no unicorns. Because there are no unicorns in this world, there are no unicorns in any world. If there was another possible world in which something like a unicorn existed, it would actually not be a unicorn.
That's true. So that's an additional, okay. So what I just said applies to tigers.
It rigidly designates the null set. That's what.
Yep.
But Matt, you were thinking of a non-fictional thing, right?
So I said, like tigers, for example. Right, there's the additional layer with unicorns that he thinks that they're necessarily non-existent. Right, so then take tiger or something. It's not super clear what it would be for a predicate to refer to the same thing in all possible worlds, because even Kripke would agree that which things are tigers is going to vary. There's going to be different tiger population in different possible worlds. So once you have a predicate that refers to, who knows what predicates refer to, but let's say the things that are tigers, the different things are going to be tigers in different worlds. So there's a lot of, like, kind of unanswered questions about what exactly, how strong is this parallel between names right. and these.
I think in the
concepts.
Case of tigers, what's fixed is not the extension, though.
It's it can't be
the intention. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It's the concept or the or whatever you would call it, the kind itself.
Something. But, yeah.
But in the case of red, I'm not sure what you do with those non-natural kind type of predicates.
But the same questions that we're just trying to consider and shove into Kripke about personal identity over time, you know, evolutionary identity of the species over time, it seems like that would make it worse. You know, if different things had happened and different populations had, then obviously the species of tiger might not have evolved in that way. And
so
there was something very close to a species of tiger, such that in the actual world, if we found something like this, we might call it a new type of tiger, then in that possible world, would it be a tiger?
So you have to fancy up your notion of denoting, basically, or designating, because the normal notion of what predicates designate is, you know, a set of things that fall under the predicate. So you have to mess with that a little bit, perhaps in a way that Wes suggested, talking about the intention, whatever exactly that is, or the kinds, or whatever kinds are.
I think we have to say that for the audience. So extension is just what we've been talking about as the referent, except that an individual term has a referent, whereas a general term would have as its referent multiple things. And so we say that is the extension of the term, whereas the intention is supposed to be a way of picking it out by a definite description or something, or a Frege sense, one of these kind of things. So I'm not sure how Kripke could even use intentions, given that he's been against, you know, using descriptions.
Yeah, you're right. On that notion of intention, it wouldn't work. It'd have to be, oh boy, we're going to get really jargony here for a second. Hyperintention.
Oh, really? All right.
What is a hyperintention? So,
I think we have to bail out of the hot air balloon at this point. No, go ahead.
So that's supposed to be something even more fine-grained than intention. So you can actually get an example of this in proper names. So if you think that a proper name has a really specific sense, even more fine-grained than a description, so it makes even more distinctions than a description does. So the problem that motivates hyperintentions is sometimes referred to as the problem of logical omniscience.
What authors is this associated with?
Robert Stalnaker and David Lewis, and I believe it comes up in some of Kripke's stuff as well. Basically, anybody who does possible world semantics, this comes up for. So if you want to understand a proposition as all the worlds in which it's true, which is a thing that a lot of people want to do, so the claim that the cat is on the mat is just the set of all possible worlds in which the cat is on the mat. That gets weird when you look at necessary statements, because the statement 2 + 2 = 4 will just be the set of all possible worlds because it's necessarily true. But then you get this thing where all arithmetical statements look synonymous. If the meaning of an arithmetical statement is just a set of worlds and every true arithmetical statement is the set of all the worlds, then it seems like they all mean the same thing and that we're not making distinctions between different meanings. So some people have tried to argue that Frege's original notion of sense is actually something even finer than what became an intention. And I think you were actually sort of going there just now a little bit in your remark that intentions aren't going to do the trick.
Yeah. All right. But now we should move on to the second of the three things that Wes wanted us to wrap up with, which is talking more about scientific identities in order to set up this mind-body thing that we're going to conclude with.
So in the same way that water is identical to H2O, we're going to say that heat is identical to the motion of molecules. And this is interesting because we kind of use heat in this equivocal way where we talk about the subjective sensation of the phenomena, but that's just for Kripke is the way that we fix the thing we're designating, in the same way that being clear and in the ocean or any other property that we might use to fix the reference for water, we use this feeling of heat to fix the phenomenon of heat. But it's not the case that that feeling itself is a necessary part of it, because there could be creatures, in other possible words, we might not even have had the nerve endings to sense heat, but that wouldn't mean that there's no such thing as heat.
So we're ruled out as existing in other possible worlds with different parents, but we are not ruled out as potentially being creatures that don't feel heat.
Right. Right.
I thought we were ruled out as creatures that don't feel heat, but that doesn't mean that heat doesn't exist.
Right.
Or there could be creatures, just not us, in the other possible world.
So there's also, he talks about this interesting case of light. We can't think of light simply as our perceptions of light or sound, those particular perceptions. And he even talks about this hypothetical case in which we might see via sounds. Dylan and I were actually talking about this at some point.
Yeah.
It's not even hypothetical, because some blind people will naturally start using clicking sounds as sonar. And then you can look at their brain and the brain activity they're having. They'll insist that they're seeing this way, by the way, that it's not just something that helps them get around, but they actually see things.
And that was an episode of Invisibilia, wasn't it, about that?
Yes, yes, exactly. And if you look at their brain activity, they actually are seeing. And you could do the same thing with a tongue, by the way, or you could use the skin actually to see. So you put something on the skin and it translates light into certain taps or stimuli, and eventually your brain will start to read that data as visual data.
So Daredevil is actually a scientific treatise.
Scientifically valid.
That comic.
What's Daredevil?
Daredevil is a Marvel who sees with sonar and becomes a gymnast ninja guy. Okay.
Though strangely, in the TV version of it, he doesn't do the sensible thing whenever he fights people of just turning out all the lights. He's constantly fighting in the daylight and in the street lights and stuff like that. And if he had a brain in his head, he'd turn out all the lights and leverage his advantage.
It's probably just like, you think just because I'm blind, I'm going to turn out all
of
the
course.
Lights?
Come Anybody
on. Yeah,
who
I'm
was
so using... sick of that party trick, guys. Come on. Yeah, that's right. It's ableist. Yeah,
it's
people are being
ableist. Okay, so are we going to get to the third one?
But I guess just think of Kripke's intuitions here, contrast them with Bishop Berkeley's intuitions, who thought that, of course, heat, the essential property of heat is the thing that we feel. And in fact, there's nothing else to it than that.
Right.
It doesn't even make sense to talk about anything beyond that. But
yeah, Kripke is totally parting company with classical empiricists with this heat example.
Yeah. Saying that how we feel is the reference fixing. We're fixing the reference.
And it's a priori contingent. Whereas the motion of molecules part of it is a posteriori necessary. So they're both kind of against the tradition.
Well, this seems a clear case to me of one where our definition of heat may be changed or enlarged as we did some science, that we all thought that it was just the thing that we feel, and then we discovered more. And
so you're talking about the definition changing, but the question is whether the referent changes.
I thought he had opinions about both, but maybe since it's not a central point, I should not pick on him. Yeah, at this
I'm just
point
saying for him, the meaning and the referent are two different
things. Yeah, it's tricky. So he's a little open about it. And some of his followers think that they're the same, but they're not. There's lots of different schools of thought on that.
Supposedly, we were always, even when we had no scientific knowledge, we were always referring to the motion of molecules.
What we're referring to is we're saying whatever thing this is that causes me to have these feelings. And it's not like we know it's the motion of molecules. We could have discovered it was something else. But if it does turn out, when we discover what it is, that it's the motion of molecules, then necessarily it is so across all possible worlds. Yeah.
Yeah. So we fix the reference via our feeling, but we're just fixing the reference. It's not part of the definitional features of. Yeah.
In the same way that there could be a qualitatively identical table in another world, but according to Kripke's intuitions, if it was made of different stuff, it's actually not the same table as the table in our world. If in some possible world there were creatures that had a sensation that's exactly like our sensation of heat, and it was triggered by something else, by photons, then that is a situation in which they're not actually feeling heat. They're having a sensation, but heat is not the thing causing it.
They're having a heat feeling, but the heat feeling is not caused by heat.
And that's not counterintuitive at all.
So this is important because this is where you can distinguish the subjective feeling from the thing that's causing it.
Exactly, yeah. It's like if you were hypothesizing, what if Matt were a plant or something? You're not really talking about Matt. You're talking about something that's somehow Matt-like, even though it's a plant. You can't be talking about Matt because it's an essential feature of Matt that he's an animal or, you know. But it's the same argument now applied to this heat case.
All right, so the thing you've been building for, pain. What is pain like heat? Make the same argument. Say the pain is identical with a brain state. Maybe we don't even know what brain state it is, but there is a particular brain state. Whatever one we discover is associated with it when we do our neural scans. Let's say we do find something. Then now we know that, let's just call it brain state P, that always happens whenever pain happens, and it only happens when pain happens. So can't we say, just like water is H2O, that brain state is in fact pain? Just like we say that heat is, well, the thing that causes.
So it's worth saying here that we could be talking about token-token identity here, where a particular individual brain state in the world is identical to a particular subjective feeling of pain. But I think it's easier for us actually just to do the type example because it's more analogous to the heat and the movement of molecules. So where we would say pain is the stimulation of C fibers in the same way that heat is the motion of molecules. some philosophers want to use this to explain the mind-body problem, where this, you know, this brain state is just identical to pain. And it seems like the contingency in the case of the heat example might help us, because we said that while it's necessarily the case that heat is the motion of molecules, it's not necessarily the case that heat corresponds to a heat feeling, this yes. phenomenal feeling of having heat.
Whereas that's different for pain and C fibers.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's necessarily the case in that theory that pain is C fiber stimulation.
But the difference is supposed to be that some other creature in another possible world could have the phenomenal experience of heat without there actually being heat in that
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
Or like that's not what's stimulating him. But yet if you are having pain, then there's no correspondence. I mean, the analogy would have to be the thing that's causing the pain, not the brain state.
The thing that's pain just is the feeling of pain, whereas it's not the case with heat. The thing that's heat is not just the feeling of heat. So we're not going to be able to get away from it in the same way. If the thing pain just is the feeling of pain, we can't attribute identity between pain and the brain state, because it'll end up being necessary in all possible worlds, when in fact we can imagine a case in which there's a brain state without the pain, or pain without the brain state. So the reason why the whole heat motion of molecules came in is to save the identity theorist from it being a necessary identity. Because if it's a necessary identity between C fibers and pain, then it screws up our intuition that the two aren't necessarily related. Now, we know there's a physical necessity between them, right? We know that in this world, in the actual world, if there's a certain brain state, there's pain. Or if there's pain, there must be a brain state, given our laws of the universe. But we can imagine a...
Well, you don't want to say physical. You don't want to say necessity, right? Because that implies something modal.
No, it's physical necessity, as distinguished from this modal necessity, which I'm not sure the relation... I want to call it metaphysical necessity, because I think logical necessity might be something different. But
yeah, I think that's a good term for what he's after.
Yeah. So even though it's physically necessary, given the laws of this universe, it's the case that in some other universe... there are different law in the same way that the inverse square law for the gravitational relationship might have differed. It might have been inverse cube. In fact, you know, Newton goes into that. It's conceivably the case that there are other laws of the universe such that a given brain state that in this world causes pain doesn't cause pain in that other world, and vice versa. So there can't be metaphysical necessity to this identity. So then that's where the brain identity theorist must have some sort of contingent property that intervene, and they usually think of the causal function of the brain state as being that contingent property. And Kripke is saying no, because when we say pain, we just mean the subjective feeling. That might not be entirely clear, but
yeah, it's a tricky one. This part, it's a tricky one. I mean, it's especially tricky to see why there's the disanalogy, because the way he sets it up, it sounds like there should be an analogy. It sounds like there should be molecular motion is to stimulation of C fibers as feeling of heat is to feeling of ow. It seems like those should line up. And yet he wants to say the feeling of ow doesn't play the same role, you know, vis-a-vis stimulation of C fibers as the feeling of heat plays vis-a-vis the movement of molecules.
Well, in the heat case, there's three terms here.
Exactly.
There's observer,
yep.
There's the feeling of heat, and then there's the heat. In the brain case, yeah, there's observer, there's feeling of pain, and then there's pain, but the feeling of pain is collapsed with the thing that is pain.
Mm-hmm. So let me just read the quote of him. So he's just talked about the heat case. Now, can something be said analogously to explain away the feeling that the identity of pain and the stimulation of C fibers, if it is a scientific discovery, could have turned out otherwise? I do not see that such an analogy is possible. In the case of the apparent possibility that molecular motion might have existed in the absence of heat, what seemed really possible is that molecular motion should have existed without being felt as heat. That is, it might have existed without producing the sensation S, the sensation of heat. In the appropriate sentient beings, is it analogously possible that a stimulation of C fibers should have existed without being felt as pain? If this is possible, then the stimulation of C fibers can itself exist without pain. Since for it to exist without being felt as pain is for it to exist without there being any pain. Such a situation would be flat out in contradiction with the supposed necessary identity of pain and the corresponding physical state. And the analog holds for any physical state which might be identified with the corresponding mental state.
So for the identity theorist, they want to say that the thing that makes the brain state identical with pain is a contingent property, which is to say its causal function. causal function that leads it to being pain, so that it's contingent. They can explain the fact that even though a certain kind of brain state is identical with pain, it might have been the case that it wasn't in another possible world. The reason would be is because the brain state didn't have that contingent causal property of causing pain in that other causal world. That's what he's saying is absurd, because in that case, you'd be saying in that other possible world, hey, this brain state is identical to pain, but it's not pain because it doesn't have the phenomenal feel of pain, right? You're just equivocating on those two things. It can't be identical to pain and yet not cause the feeling of pain, something like that. I know. It's still confusing.
Yeah.
Was there enough here to see whether you find it convincing or not?
Well, I found this distinction completely convincing, that the equation between C fibers and pain is distinct from the feeling of heat and the motion of molecules, for exactly the reason that Wes pointed out, that is a three-term relation versus a two-term relation.
Does that constitute an argument against identity theses?
Well, I didn't know that that's exactly what he was arguing against. I thought he was qualifying the status of certain identity theses.
He's saying that you can't assert an identity between C fibers, you know, doing their thing, and pain.
Because you can imagine situations in which one occurs in which the other does not, but I don't.
Oh, I'm totally confused then, because I thought he was arguing exactly the opposite. I thought he was arguing that because of the C fibers being activated is equal to pain.
No, he's saying it's not equal to pain.
Yeah, it's like he thinks they're not identical, and then what he's arguing is that you can't use his clever Kripke stuff from these lectures to argue against the intuition that they can come apart, stimulation of C fibers and pain can come apart, the way you can, he thinks, use his clever Kripke stuff to argue against the intuition that the feeling of heat and molecular motion can come apart.
Yeah.
So you might have said, well, it could have turned out that we discovered that heat was something else. And I'll prove it. I'll show you a possible world in which we have the feeling of heat and yet something else is causing it. It's not the motion of molecules. And Kripke answers, well, no, you have not shown in that case that heat turned out to be something else. You've shown that a certain sensation turned out to have a different cause. But heat does not refer to the sensation. Heat already referred to the cause. And so the Rydzic designator heat, though it is not, you know, rigidly tied to it causes that thing. It's a contingent matter that it causes that thing in us, but it is rigidly tied to being the motion of molecules.
Okay.
Yeah. And whereas you can't make the same loop about mind and body.
Let me try again with this too. The identity theory says that the C fiber stimulation is identical with pain, and that identity can't be necessary identity. And here's why. Because we can do a thought experiment where we say, oh, what if there was a brain state without the feeling of pain, or that there was a feeling of pain without the brain state? Now, if you think we've prejudiced ourselves with that intuition, we haven't, because even though we know that there's a physically necessary relationship between them, we can conceive of worlds in which the laws of chemistry and physics differ such that the brain state, the C-fiber brain state, doesn't produce pain. So it's certainly a metaphysical possibility, even if it's not a physical possibility.
Or that there's pain without that brain state.
Yeah. So then the identity theorist needs to show how it's a contingent identity. And to do that, they come up with the idea that there's this contingent causal property that the brain has in this world that it doesn't have in the cases where it doesn't produce the feeling of pain, and that that causal property is the operator. The problem with that is then you get this weird situation where you're saying that the C fibers activity is identical to pain, but it's somehow not the phenomenal feeling of pain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So could you have pain without it being the phenomenal feeling of pain? No, that's the definition of pain. It is a phenomenal feeling. That's not the definition of heat. Heat is not a phenomenal feeling. Heat and the feeling of heat are different. Pain and the feeling of pain are not different.
So it sounds to me like what I was missing was the way in which Kripke, in the analysis of the pain and C fibers, was showing that there are actually three terms in the phenomenal experience of pain, and that the C-fiber equivalence theory really only has two terms, so they don't map to one another.
So in other words, in the case of the water, where we say, what if it was a case that water was not H2O? Then we get a thing where It's really, it's not that water is not HTO, because we know that's necessarily true. It's that there's a water lookalike that's not H2O.
Because of the sense experience of H2O.
Yeah. So in the same case, heat is necessarily molecular motion in all possible worlds, but it's not the case that the heat feeling is necessarily equal to molecular motion in all possible worlds. So when you get to the pain example, if you say that pain is identical to C fibers, and then you say because it's contingent, it's not the case in all possible worlds that the pain feeling equals the C fiber stimulation. Well, you can't distinguish that from a pain lookalike. There's no distinction in the same way that there's a water lookalike to be distinguished from water. There's no pain lookalike to be distinguished from pain. Any pain lookalike would just be pain.
Yeah, exactly. There's no such thing as a pain seeming as opposed to, you know, pain seeming versus actual pain. But there is such a thing as seeming heat as opposed to actual heat.
Right.
So I don't know if I have any strong opinions. I'm not particularly convinced that this is any kind of real argument against identity theory. Our intuitions about these things are not so clear as he would make us believe. That I think, again, I know I said this earlier, was that if we discovered, you know, in some other possible world, to bring up the example from the intro, cats are demons. He wants to say our intuitions tell us it's not that cats are demons in this other possible world. It's that there are no cats. There are demons that look like cats. There are demons that are fool's cats, like fool's gold. They're fool's cats. So if you think that that is just a really clear intuition, then what you're saying is that what things are in the world is not really have anything to do with what functional role they serve in our lives, how they appear to us. We don't create concepts by dividing up our sensations. What we really do is point out actual things, actual kinds that are in the world. And those then, there are metaphysical truths about those things. So it's a very realist, Aristotelian kind of picture. And I just think our intuitions are not so clear, so that it makes just as much sense, again, to talk about, well, it's not that it would be a different table in the world, that the table was made of a slightly different kind of wood. It's just that what my table is the functional role it serves, how it connects to all the other objects in the room and my experiences of it. And so in the same thing, to say that heat, you know, the feeling of heat could actually be caused by something else in another world seems just bizarre and crazy to me. That just like pain, if in the other world these creatures have the feeling of heat, then they are actually feeling heat, even if that thing is actually not the motion of molecules. It's just that in that other world, heat actually does happen to be something different. I think our intuitions come apart. They're equally strong cases you could make for this phenomenal picture and the realist picture that he's making. And I just don't see the justification for him preferring one over the other and thereby using it as an argument against identity theory.
Well, I thought it was stronger than that. And I think this is actually kind of a technical foray and a way to defend identity theory. So the intuitive idea is that, you know, you can have a brain state without thoughts, or in certain possible hypotheticals, we could be zombies, right? The whole Chalmers thing. We could just, you know, we could have all the same brain states, but have no thoughts correspond to them, which I've explained. And that certainly is a possibility.
Why would the identity thesis admit that that's a real possibility? That's just an apparent possibility, according to the identity thesis.
No. Why is that? That's a real possibility.
Well, just like it's an apparent possibility, well, maybe water could have been something else. Well, if we discover that pains are, in fact, these brain states in our world, then...
I'm not saying pain could have been something else, though.
You're saying that there could have been a brain state without pain or without whatever the mental feature is. That is the same as saying, well, it's not the same as saying that the mental state could have been instantiated in a different physical way, but those claims rise and fall together. You're saying they're separable. That's what the person who argues for zombies.
I'm not sure what you're saying exactly. Are you trying to say that if the brain states didn't have pains associated with them, then they wouldn't be brain states? Is that your...
They wouldn't be that particular kind of brain state, yes. If you admit that in this world, the pain... Well, see, I guess that's what the person arguing against identity theory is not going to admit, that the brain states, even in this world, as a matter of physical necessity, are always associated with the pains.
Well, they could admit that. That's fine. You can admit they're always associated in this world.
They're associated, but they are not equivalent to. Because if they were...
Right.
Because these are seem to be rigid designators, then according to, then it would work. Then it would be the case in all possible worlds. Anyway, I don't think we're going to settle the zombie argument. I think we need to have another episode on this.
But you see the general line there. Yeah, they would rigidly designate it would be the same in all possible worlds, and you could never do that zombie thought experiment. So then there's a trick to get around that where you come up with this contingent causal property, and then he thinks he shows why that doesn't work. So I think it's quite strong in the sense that he's not really – he's doing something a little new. He's using his technical apparatus to argue for something people have argued for in other ways. So the general gist of it, at least.
One thing on Mark's earlier point about, so it sounds like Mark has strong intuitions that for many artifactual kinds, their essence has a lot to do with the use we put them to or something like that, or the role they play in society.
Or even natural kinds, water, the thing that flows in rivers and streams. Yeah. You know, if there really was another world where there was a different thing that flowed in rivers and streams, a different chemical thing, but yet it had all the same properties, it nourished us in the same way, why wouldn't we want to just call that water? It's functional water. Functionally equivalent.
And this is the subject of Putnam's, right? So the twin earth, this is where the twin earth thing comes from. Yeah, so and then maybe we even want to extend that to natural kinds as well. Maybe even gold atoms derive their essence from the use to which humans put gold atoms or something like that, or the role the gold atoms play in society. And I'm actually pretty sympathetic to that account of what an essence is. But I think, interestingly, you can bring a lot of that in and make it compatible with Kripke's argument. What you can't do is you can't make it necessarily compatible with all the specific examples he chooses of this is a necessary property of that. But the general argument about, like, if such and such is a necessary property of this thing, then when we reason in these what if scenarios about what if the thing didn't have the property, then that whole story you can hold on to. Basically, what ends up happening is you just change the examples of what's an essential property of what to fit your picture of what essences are. So for whatever that's worth. So if you wanted to try to synthesize your view with Kripke's, I think it's doable.
Which seems to take a lot of the juice out of, so that's really saying that what Kripke's big advance here is just the way of stating the problem, his way of talking about possible worlds in a way that does not have the counterintuitive things that come up when you're talking, you know, in the way David Lewis talks about them, the way of talking about metaphysical necessity without positing these weird Aristotelian essences that we don't even know what they are, but yet still being able to not just say, oh, essences are just what society called. You know, it has to do with how we essentially deal with them or something. They're not human dependent. There are sensible ways of talking about essential properties and a lot of the other basic metaphysical stuff without causing any of these problems that past thinkers had. There's a way of modernizing Aristotle.
Yeah, that's the way I actually I thought a lot about Aristotle while I was reading. I mean, I didn't think. I just free associated to Aristotle.
You referred
to
Aristotle.
Rorty telling you that? It wasn't the Rorty?
That piece is so horrible, I don't even know where to begin.
We'll link people to this little Richard Rorty, a very famous postmodernist sort of, or, you know, neo-pragmatist. We'll do a Rorty episode soon if you don't know who that is. But he just had an interesting, very high-level take on that, you know, Kripke was reviving Aristotelian realism against this Kantian slash pragmatist slash, you know, really putting all these people like Frege and the pragmatists together and the psychologists that would not have wanted to be together. But it's an interesting take. It's simple enough to be understandable that Kripke is a return to realism.
Matt, what's your general opinion of Rorty?
I'm more of a Percyan pragmatist than a Rortian pragmatist. I think it's kind of hard to figure out exactly where he stands.
So I had him pegged as a relativist. And this Mirror of Nature book, I think, was what piss me off. And
well, future episode. Yes. Dylan, do you have a closing here?
I found the book really, really interesting, and I was blown away when I read the preface that these are all but transcripts of lectures that he gave basically extemporaneously and three different lectures of, I guess, a week apart. And I found it benefited a lot in reading it from that lecture style, and made a lot of it very accessible and interesting. I found that maybe this was a consequence of the way the lectures were surely to a relatively knowledgeable audience. And I felt the same kind of thing happening on the podcast here, is that we sort of just jumped into details that are interesting, but I found myself just wondering, why are we talking about these details? What is the question that is being answered by this discussion? Not that the discussion isn't interesting, but that I was finding myself searching for a more sufficient grounding in what was really at stake and what was going on. And I got a lot of that in our discussion tonight, so I appreciate that.
I'm going to posit that in the possible world where Seth showed up, he would have said that same thing.
Okay, fair enough.
And that therefore Seth and Dylan are identical.
That's right.
I refer to Seth.
The reference is fixed only by a description of having this reaction to Kripke. So.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's not rigid. Come on.
So I also found the discussions at the end, and this is why I was so, I mean, maybe it's just obvious why I'd be interested in it, but the discussions of essence, identity, and scientific theory and natural kinds, really interesting that they would come naturally out of discussions of what the names of things are. And I mainly found that discussion interesting without necessarily coming to any kind of particular conclusions from it. And I think that's a function of the way the book works. Anyway, that's my little take.
Well, if you're going to choose an analytic philosophy book and, you know, how notoriously, the obscurity of the problems they seem interested in, this is a great one to actually tackle, that you will understand it. Even if you couldn't follow what we're talking about here, you will understand this book, I think, through most of it. He puts things, the scholarly disputes that he has with others, mostly into footnotes that you can more or less ignore, although I found them very clarifying in many places. But, you know, he just has a wonderful style. Just be so grateful that modal logic, all this talk of possible worlds is founded on a very difficult modal symbolic logic edifice that Kripke was one of the guys that helped initiate, I guess, like
when he was 16. Teens, yeah.
He did some.
And he's actually a mathematician. I don't know if we mentioned that.
He developed the symbolism and stuff, but he hardly ever, like a little bit in the preface, you know, the added later preface, he pulls out a little symbolism, just a little bit, but for the most part, there's no symbols here, which is very rare for a book about this kind of topic.
Can I say something really quickly about his modal logic thing? It's sometimes referred to as the relational semantics for modal logic, never mind what that means, but what he did in that work was, because this came up in our discussion, he came up with a unified theory of what like necessary or must or should, words like these mean, regardless of whether you're talking about metaphysical necessity or physical necessity or laws of ethics. He sort of brought all those different flavors of necessity under a single heading and with a general theory about how they're all related to each other and they're all different. So it was a very significant achievement.
So what's the text to read on that?
A couple papers. Semantical Considerations of Modal Logic is the one. You mean primary text by Kripke or do you like more modern stuff?
Either really, but yeah.
Yeah, Semantical Considerations of Modal Logic would be the one that's most commonly looked at. There are a couple other papers too. I forget the titles. It's something like Completeness Proof for S5, something like that. I don't know. I have to look it up.
Really eye-catching titles like that?
Okay. Yeah.
But I could definitely recommend, if people are interested in a nice, readable, introductory exposition of what the relational semantics for modal logic is all about. There's definitely stuff like that available.
Okay.
And so he wrote a couple actual books. Did he even? Like, I know he's sort of notorious for just having, you had a whole elucidations episode on just all the notes that are scattered around and how those are being collected, even though he's not dead
yet,
right?
Oh, no, he's still on the faculty at CUNY. He's still writing stuff. He's been writing stuff since the 70s, but he has been a little bit shy about publishing stuff. And only recently have his friends finally coaxed him into publishing stuff again. So in the past, you know, 5-6 years. Actually, my father's been working on that a little bit. He's been doing some copy editing because in a lot of cases, less so for the technical stuff, which he would sit down and write, but especially this more philosophical stuff, his preferred method of writing was to give a lecture, transcribe it, and then go clean up the transcription. And you can see that it really works well in this case.
Yeah, this was, I had the same reaction as Dylan and Mark, just the clarity of it and the style. It's a really interesting book, and I'm generally not into this type of stuff, so I can say that it's my favorite work of analytic philosophy so far. But also, I think what was so appealing about it is just I knew I had a vague uneasiness about the whole definite descriptions approach, but I don't think I had a way to put my finger on that. So this whole idea of rigid designators, I found it actually enormously intuitively appealing, even though, you know, of course, there are problems that crop up as well. And then the other part of it, just this causal theory of reference, I think Dylan was saying it seemed intuitively plausible as well. And I had the same sort of reaction that this is a much better way to go about things. So it was kind of really revealing in that sense. And in a way, it felt like a sort of revolutionary, and Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but critique of a lot of the analytic philosophy preceding it. But that's just, you know, that's a layman's kind of impression there. So
yeah, it's definitely played the role of so a lot of analytic philosophy between Carnap and this text was very anti-metaphysics, and this text is often credited with rehabilitating metaphysics and making it acceptable to do again. in mainstream philosophy. And I think that's probably true. I think it probably did have that effect.
So what's your closing, Matt?
So I'm really happy you guys liked it. I like this book a lot. It's really fun to read, as you mentioned. But a lot of my friends had it shoved down their throats when they were young uns in philosophy classes and thus have negative feelings about it. So kind of for that reason, even though I love this book, I'm a little bit hesitant to recommend it to people because I know that there's a sensitive history with a lot of people, like, you know, they must worship at the Church of Kripke. Anyway, so I'm just kind of generally psyched that you guys seem to like it. It's been influential in all kinds of ways. The causal theory of reference that we mentioned, this baptism picture, very influential. And that's especially been taken up by some people on the East Coast, particularly Michael Devitt. The West Coasters were more interested in the rigid designation part of the story, and they explored that a lot. One thing that his observations here gave rise to that was very significant was the theory of what are called indexicals. So words like I and now and these sort of very context-dependent expressions. Actually, in my opinion, that whole sort of approach to those very tricky context-sensitive expressions since the 60s comes out of his remarks in this book about how when I say this refers to the same thing in all possible worlds, I'm talking about the word as we use it in our world. So a lot of weird behavior of names like Matt in what-if sentences is replicated by the word I in what-if sentences. So he brought out a lot of really semantically really bizarre features. Work that came right after this brought out really bizarre features of words like I that required actually an overhaul of like the whole framework people were using. And then eventually turned into this area that people now call two-dimensional semantics or two-dimensional modal logic. So everybody has their favorite thing in this book that they like. My favorite thing in this book is really just there's an incredible attention to the behavior of expressions in these what-if type sentences. And I think counterfactual reasoning is really important. Reasoning about what could have been, what might be, is integral to obviously scientific theorizing. But also, I'm especially interested in stuff like reasoning about kinds of people. And also reasoning about artifacts, reasoning about social roles. And I think that reasoning about what could have been and what might be and what should be, stuff like that, is really important in those domains. I think he sort of had the effect of turning our attention to this really important topic of basically modality philosophy and with a level of subtlety that wasn't really around so much before. A little bit with Barkin Marcus and Quine and some of those debates he talks about. But yeah, I think that's one of the main things I like about this. I also, in my own work, I draw a little bit on his view that basically common nouns like tiger are natural kind terms, which is a little bit hard to hammer out the details of. But that's also something I've tried to explore a little bit.
All right. Well, thanks for adding your expertise, your interest to the discussion.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Next time, we're going to talk about John Dewey's Experience and Nature from 1925.
Oh, awesome. Great choice. That's a fascinating book.
We are supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Dennis Helmuth, Bill Mascioli, Gaston Tuafek, Charlotte Steinzig, Meredith Coral, Jeff Mullen, Nick Martin, Louise Wales, Andrew Pendakis, Leonard Williams, David Bunch, Joshua Prinsky, Linda Reeves, Hans Villami, Lucy Hutchinson, Louis Turnstall, David Richardson, Jose Skinner, Enrique Amador, Chris Statham, Joseph Kuljak, Michael Gushu, Deidre Perry, Aaron Higgins Brake, Robin Boddy, Damian Bickhoff, Stephen Lange, Mark Featherstone, Jonathan Maythaler, Giselle Stahl, Paul Davis, Michael Callahan, Marco Radinkovic, and Kevin Douglas. Thanks also to the smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site.
You're not going to read those?
In an alternate possible world, I'll add an extra hour. We've got a Facebook page you should go look at. You can join the group. There's a lot of discussion going on there. We've got a blog you can subscribe to and get things right in your inbox. Definitely reach out to us. Email us. Tell us what you think of the show, whether you want us to cover more of this kind of analytic philosophy or go back to the historical stuff or both. Thanks, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks again, and good night.
But unlucky, I stand a chance with this girl. No, it could not be. I could not deserve this good life, this family. And I said, if they should waste four walls. Well, it's reason enough. Well, it's reason enough to go on. If we should waste our all, is it reason enough? Is it reason enough? Is it reason enough? It's enough, now it's gone away. Reason enough, it's enough, now it's gone away. Reason enough, it's enough, now it's gone away, yeah. I lost in some lie that you could be standing, it's standing so still. I won't even try, watching my life slip to coals through the grill. And I say, if we should waste four walls, well, it's reason enough. Is it reason enough to go on? If we should waste on all, is it reason enough? Is it reason enough? Is it reason enough? It's enough, now it's gone away. Reason enough, it's enough, now it's gone away. Reason enough, it's enough, now it's gone away, yeah. Just a little insecurity blowing harder. Just my fatalism pissing me off this wall. I see the future and it's really not so downhearted. But optimism is fake and I can be a plague. Please don't let me drive you away. No, not in a day. Could something so precious be frittered away? No, not my last hope. Plenty more mornings to wake up the Pope. And I say, if we should waste four walls, is it reason enough? Is it reason enough to go on? We should waste our all. Is it reason enough? Is it reason enough? Yes, it's reason enough. It's enough. Now it's gone away. 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 Yeah. No.